private land, even though those canals become connected with the intercoastal waterway and navigable waters, you can still keep the shrimpers out, you can keep the hunters and fishermen out off the surface waters itself. And that goes way beyond what we've contemplated, and I really hate to see that happen in the sense of the people that I represent using and utilizing these kind of canals. And again, our people, it's clear in the record, never have intended, nor have they ever made it a purpose of this lawsuit to try to keep the public out or regulate traffic as you suggested, counsel. And to the contrary, if the court will look on page 44 of the statement of facts, when I asked Mr. McGuire, who was on the board of directors, and I said, Mr. McGuire, do you know of your own personal knowledge that neither you or the members of the board of directors when you served as president have never made any effort to exclude the general public from coming into the Tern Basin by boat? Never. Question. And it is not your contention, and never was your contention, when that particular board initiated this lawsuit, to attempt to exclude the public from coming into this canal or turning basin by boat. His answer was never. And so what is kind of unfortunate from my personal point of view is that the Supreme Court of the United States says that we can even go so far unless we get into a question of waiver, but I can see that the Supreme Court of the United States now gives my people the right, if they wanted to put a barbed wire fence out there, just like in the Mann case, that says you can't even come in on the surface water. But they won't do that, and never intended to do that. But I'm just pointing this out as what could be done based on the strength of this United States Supreme Court decision.
And you're saying that that would even apply to riparian owners, if riparian owners couldn't get...
Yes, sir. We built the canal. They didn't build the canal. Our predecessor in title built the marina and the canal and connected it. And then when they built the turning basin, the land that they bought, which by the way, I think the record will support me on this, they really are not adjacent to it. There's a narrow 5-foot
buffer.
And Judge Greenhill, when you asked a while ago about how the state got this, it's clear in the statement of facts and the stipulations. What happened is, our predecessor, our respective predecessors entitled the 7500 Bel Air Corporation, after they gave us the easement, or sold the easement to our predecessor entitled, and after they sold the land to them, then voluntarily deeded the remaining rights to the bottom of the basin to the state. The state did not buy it. And your second question is, with respect to the oil and gas rights, I can tell you that the 7500 Bel Air Corporation I'm sure retained the mineral interest. I think they did. They quit claiming their entire right to the state. That's what happened. So that...
Ordinarily, as I understand it, the state owns the beds of navigable waters, like rivers.
As long as they're natural, yes, sir.
Well, and that's the distinction here. This is an unnatural situation.
Yes, sir.
And therefore the state would not own the bottom. And
that's
all I was asking. So the
right.
State would not own the bottom, as I understand it, except by grant.
And I know counsel is not trying to purposely confuse the court, and I've got to get him credit as being ingenious as an advocate, but all of these federal cases that he cited to you, talking about the Supremacy Clause and the Commerce Clause and the absolute rights of parties, of the government to decide whether or not they build bridges and so forth, and not one of those cases is the party in the position that we are claiming a property right of any kind. They are merely, in one case, it was a sailboat club. Well, they didn't own any of the bottom lands. They just happened to use that river, and they said that span up there, and really what it amounts to is that they didn't have legal standing to sue or to bring the case because they had no ostensible property right, and neither could they show any special damage that would give them the status that would be required. So in all those cases, you can just save your time reading them because they're not anywhere close to being in point factually. I don't mean to save your time in reading them, but I'm telling you honestly, you can save your time in reading, not telling you how to do your job. But if you spend the number of hours that I spent reading all of them, I shake my head and I said, my goodness, Mr. Lane, you kept me on that rabbit trail so long, I wonder if I'm just dumb or what, but I had to read every one of them to make sure there wasn't some kernel of substantive law that supported him, and there's not any. And then, lastly, that even after you read these two cases, I know when you do this opinion, you're going to want to consider the total impact in light of it's going to change the Attorney General's opinion if you refer to the Supreme Court case United States. And I, as bad as I hate to see it, I can see people up and down the court, the coast in the future, these private developments, if they get them and keep them going, although I think waiver is a good defense. I wouldn't represent these people, by the way, as an aside, Your Honors, if they tried to keep the public out or bringing their boats in there. And they know that, and that's why I say that's not even an issue. But when they come in and say, hey, we want to put these pilings in and create this big old marina so that we can make some money off our land over here that's close to the marina, they're infringing on a clear property right that was purchased for consideration and value. And what if you buy his proposition in this case, what you are doing in essence is saying that the federal government does have the right to come in our state and just neutralize and extinguish one of our citizens' property rights. And that would be the net effect of following his reasoning. And again, fortunately...
Now, would you make that same statement if this had not been an artificially constructed lake?
No, sir. That would be entirely different. And that was the second point in this Supreme Court decision. And they remanded it because the persons, the defendants in that case, in the same status as Mr. Lang's clients were, contended in the trial court that in the process of building these canals, the landowner negatively affected existing navigable waters. And they, and see, the trial court blew them out in the Louisiana case on a motion for summary judgment. And even the Supreme Court of Louisiana said it doesn't make any difference, even if they did take an existing navigable stream and expand it. They cited the case, but the Supreme Court says that in that fact situation, they're not going to say as a matter of law that the public doesn't have an interest. So they remanded the case back to the state court to allow a trial to develop the fact issues in that case, which would determine whether or not the canal was superimposed over an existing riparian stream or a navigable body of water. But you see, that's the, again, like I said, again, and how lucky I am, and the Lord just, you know, is somehow bumping me along, and I didn't even know when we got it in there it was ultimately going to be as crucial as it turns out. But the stipulation that I gave you earlier, beginning on page 4 of the statement of facts, falls squarely in the Supreme Court case where there is no fact issue in that respect. Our people, there was no existing stream. They just went right along the shoreline. The way they do it, they actually start back for cheapness and economy and use the dredge line, and just like dredging a ditch. Then they come in, they put all the bulkheads in, and then when they're ready and they got it all done, then they just go up there with a drag line and then just take out that little dam and let all the water come in. And that's when you see the plat, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, you can see that configuration of the turning basin. Think of it as a thermometer, big old bulb at the bottom, and then the narrow channel going out, and then it breaks or breaches the shoreline into Galveston Bay.
We've seen the aerial photographs.
Oh, I didn't know whether that was in there, Your Honor, because it was so big, I thought maybe we decided that the chart would be good enough rather than clutter up the record with too much. But at any rate, when you read the Supreme Court case, I think you'll agree with me without any doubts that our fact situation falls squarely in there. The United States Supreme Court is going to help you off the hook, and it'll be the easiest case you've had today. I've listened to these others, and I don't envy you a bit having to wheedle around through all the rules and the various propositions of the lawyers, and we're just fortunate that I think that the law is clear, And again, I apologize. It's unfortunate that I didn't find these cases until today. Perhaps if I'd have had them in my respondent's brief, you would not have at all granted written this case and would have saved you time. So I feel, in some respects, that I haven't fulfilled my total responsibility to the court, and I apologize in that respect.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal arguments on petition?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I've put you to unnecessary trouble. I'm not as enthusiastic about those two cases as opposing counsel is. I think when this court, I will have to confess that I have not read those cases, but I believe I know the principles upon which they rest. And it's the same principles, more or less, that would apply if it was private ownership. But counsel's forgetting about the stipulation they entered into. On page item 5 of the stipulation that was entered into, both parties stipulate that the area in which the parties' disputed rights exist is all within a water area, which was created mechanically on or about 1963 from a dry land area owned by plaintiff's predecessor and title, and is now an extension of that body of water known as West Bay, and is considered to be, and is considered to be, a navigable body of water. Now here they're coming in and citing you two cases that they so enthusiastically say decides the case for you and holds that in a similar factual situation that the Supreme Court of the United States has held that when those facts exist that the Commerce Clause is not applicable to that body of water. We, of course, contend that by their stipulation they are not permitted now to emerge such a point because they have agreed through such stipulation that it is a navigable body of water and there's no exemption in the Commerce Clause and if it's a navigable body of water and they've agreed to it, we contend of course that it's subject to that Commerce Clause. Now this business about the Mann case being wrong and that well, there's been a lot of courts misled if it's wrong. It's been cited quite a few times. There's been cases outside of you, the federal courts are wrong. Haven't paid as much attention to those two federal cases. I think they're distinguishable. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier in my argument, there's thousands and thousands of cases on water rights, navigable water. And I'm sorry that I missed those cases.
I may be mistaken, but it seems to me that maybe there's a difference between waters, navigable waters, naturally created, and navigable waters, artificially created.
Yeah, the difference is, of course, in the Lorena case, you know, that was one of the points because they built up some land with oyster shells and it became attached to the upland and the upland owners were claiming that part as a part of their land. And the court said no because you did it artificially by putting those shells there. It remained state land.
I remember investigating a title to land adjacent to Kettle Lake. Kettle Lake at one time was very large, and when Captain Shreve undid the raft in the Red River, the water from the Kettle Lake went down, and now it's very small, relatively small.
Yeah, of course.
Now the question is, who owns the land that used to be under navigable waters and the oil under it?
Well, of course, as I remember it, lake law is a little different than navigable water law, unless the lake was connected to the water that would be classified as navigable, if I remember correctly, the owners own to the proportionally to the center of the lake.
The question is, do you agree or don't you that there's different law applicable to artificially created navigable waters and naturally created waters?
I do. There is a difference.
And who owns the bottom would be different.
That's right.
And who would have a right to give a permit to put something there might be
right.
Different.
But you see, they have stipulated. Can they ignore that stipulation? I don't think they can.
Ted Walker knows.
They have stipulated what they're trying to come in and, well, they have exercised great jubilation over it. And I think they better look at this stipulation again, because that was the purpose of the stipulation, to avoid any question on that point. Now they're seeking to bring up a question on that point. I thank the court and I bid you well on your decision.
Thank you. Case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments of both parties. That concludes the oral submission.
Cause the rendition of an improper judgment, and substantial injustice would be done if this case is if this case is affirmed at this stage, because of issues that were not genuinely in dispute at the trial level.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Suppose the trial court had admitted the security agreement into evidence and rendered the same judgment that it did render. Would you have had a complaint then about the judgment?
Well.
And what would it be?
Your Honor, the fact of the matter, quite candidly, is that both Marathon and Fondren did not put on enough evidence for the court to make its ruling. This is true. Marathon did not prove the amount of debt, the amount of indebtedness owing to it on the day of trial, nor did Fondren. I would submit that truly the only issue at the trial level was which party, Fondren or Marathon, had the superior right to this account of their common debtor. Having made that determination, the trial court having determined that Fondren's right was superior to that of Marathon, or vice versa, as the trial court in fact concluded, having made that decision, then it is purely a mechanical, a ministerial task to determine the exact amount of indebtedness and to determine who ought to get the money.
Assuming it is a ministerial matter of arithmetic, what judgment could the trial court have possibly entered for you, even if the security agreement had been admitted?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose the trial court could have entered the same type of judgment for Fondren that it in fact entered the Marathon, I would concede that that judgment may well have been reviewable because of the error or because of the absence of evidence on the amount of damages. But let me hasten to add, this case, the trial was in February of 1970. Here we are in October of 1980, a year and a half later. As the Beaumont Court of Appeals acknowledged in Leif Johnson Ford, a case which we have cited, events could have transpired over the year and a half between date of trial and today. It is theoretically possible that Marathon has been paid in full by Southwest Metals. It is likewise theoretically possible that Fondren has been paid in full by Southwest Metals. There are the amount of damages now today, like the amount of damages on the day of trial, is not demonstrable now, but it is purely, I would submit, a mechanical function. Having determined the priorities of the party, which party is entitled to prevail, then the step is very simple, perhaps by way of summary judgment, perhaps with no contest by the parties. Having determined which party, Fondren or Marathon, is entitled to that account obligation. And obviously, if Marathon, the amount of money was about $6,400, $800 of which was paid to Renault as attorney's fees by agreement of all the parties. So we're talking about $5,800. If the sum owing today to Fondren were, say, only $3,000, which, to be sure, the difference, if any, ought to go to Marathon. And there are going to need to be further determinations, I would submit in this case, on the element of damages as the case stands now, because there's no evidence showing the amount owing to Marathon either on day of trial or today, of course. For these reasons, I would submit that the error of the trial court, the now undisputed error of the trial court, did indeed result in a judgment prejudicial to Fondren, that it was not harmless error.
Well, and how was it harmed if you had rested your case without putting on what you now concede as essential evidence?
Your Honor, the procedural posture of the case at the trial level is somewhat convoluted. What had happened was Marathon had issued out its writ of garnishment against Renault. Then Renault filed its inner pleader. Then Fondren filed suit against Renault, and all these matters were consolidated. So what the trial judge was faced with was a prospect of two creditors litigating over a common fund, and neither creditor established at trial the amount owing to it on the day of trial, because, I would submit, the only genuine issue in dispute at that time was who came first. That was the issue. Having determined who came first, then it's a routine task to determine.
Well, we just don't have a routine motion or judgment after a final judgment has already been entered. That's what would have been entered, wouldn't it, when you rest?
Well, Your Honor, Marathon put on its case first, and then Fondren, and then we both, Fondren put on its case after Marathon had rested. Now, there being no evidence as to the amount of indebtedness owing to either party on the day of trial, there would be some requirement to make that determination at this stage. I thank the court for its consideration.
Court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.
May it please the court, I am Rhett Campbell, appearing in behalf of Marathon Paterno Company, the respondent in this case, and the prevailing party in both the trial court and the Court of Civil Appeals. I'd like to welcome the court to the esoteric and ephemeral world of liens, garnishments, attachments, and priorities, as opposed to the somewhat ephemeral world of divorce and family law to which I have been subjected this morning. I would like to first address...
We have to take them all, counsel.
I became very sympathetic to that this morning, Your Honor.
We're in the general practice of the law.
I understand. I think Judge Dyes may not have done you any favors by writing. I'd like to first address the argument of opposing counsel that Marathon did not prove the amount of its debt owing to it, and that therefore there was apparently some failure of proof by Marathon at the trial. I disagree with that. I think that this is the first time that has been raised was in the reply brief of the appellant in the Court of Civil Appeals. I first of all refer the court to the findings of fact that the trial court entered, where it specifically found that plaintiff Marathon Paterno Company recovered judgment for $21,000 plus interest, cost, attorney's fees, all of which are presently due and unpaid. And that was as of the date that the judgment was entered. As far as I know, that portion of the findings of fact were never disputed or argued against by Fondren Southwest Bank until the reply brief that they filed in the Court of Civil Appeals, although I may stand to be corrected on that. At any rate, there was a specific amount that was shown by a certified copy of the abstract of judgment. A specific amount was shown to be owed and unpaid, and of course on the credit column of that, which is in evidence before this court, shows zero amount had been paid, none. The Court of Civil Appeals, in its opinion, of course, found that Marathon was a judgment creditor and was entitled to $21,756. That, again, was a finding of fact by the Court of Civil Appeals. I think it is very clear that there was no failure of proof on the part of Marathon, that we did establish our right to recover at least $21,000 if that amount of money had been owed by Renault to Southwest Metal Specialty. So I think that point is just wrong, not proper. The issues, as otherwise set forth by opposing counsel and petitioner's argument, I think is correct. We did disagree at one time whether the security agreement should have been admitted into evidence. The Court of Civil Appeals ruled that that was error, that it should have been admitted. We do agree that that is not before this court at this time. The security agreement was an exhibit. It is therefore part of the record. And I think the correct posture of the case now is what should the trial court's judgment have been if the security agreement had been admitted into evidence? And as one of the questions was put to opposing counsel, assuming that that agreement was a proper exhibit and was considered by the trial court, and assuming that the judgment was entered anyway, what have you to complain of? Was it, in essence, harmless error? It is our position, of course, that it was harmless error, that they would have nothing to complain of because they failed to meet their burden of proof. We have basically four reasons why we think the judgment of the trial court and of the Court of Civil Appeals can be sustained, even with the security agreement as part of the evidence. Number one, failure of proof. This is a question not of validity of a lien, but of a priority of liens. If the security agreement had been admitted into evidence, let's assume that Mr. Skowronek, the vice president of the bank, did testify as to the existence of the debt, which we don't agree with, but it is in the record. Assuming that, the most that Fondren Bank can get out of that is a valid security interest. But in order for it to be prior to that of Marathon's security interest, it has to be prior in time to be prior in right. And what evidence is there of the amount of the debt? What evidence is there as to when that debt came into existence or when the security agreement attached? This was what the Court of Civil Appeals focused on in their opinion. And this is why we believe that although it may be proper at this point to argue that Fondren may have had a valid security interest, they did not, by competent evidence, establish a prior security interest. And that is the difference in the case as we offer it to this court.
They testified they were always owed some money from 1974 continuously to the date of your trial.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that is all the testimony that was offered. That is an accurate, this is a simple case in that regard. The totality of the testimony regarding the debt that was owed by Southwest to the bank is we were owed this money continuously since 1974-75.
And whatever that amount was would have priority then, wouldn't it?
If you believed that witness, and if it had come under this security agreement, if it had been value given in connection with this security agreement, and if it was, in fact, in existence since that period of time, that's correct. Yes, sir.
No, you got to have the amount of evidence.
Well, that, of course, is our argument. That's right, sir. It, conceptually, it gets down to an even, I think, smaller question of how do you define a debt. To have a valid security agreement that you're going to recover money from, you've got to have an underlying obligation. You know, you can have a security interest on a debt that later on the debt gets paid. Banks do that all the time. They extend credit, they bring it back, they extend credit, they pay it back, you have letters of credit, but you may have an all-encompassing security agreement. At a particular point in time, the question is there any underlying indebtedness? How much money is owed? Our point is, and I think this is the Court of Civil Appeals point, is that the definition of debt necessarily includes amount. And for an officer of the bank to simply testify, oh, we've been owed money since 1974, when incidentally that employee had only been there since 1977, which is the reason that I say that we do not agree that this was a fact before the trial, that was found by the trial court, or a fact that was found by the Court of Civil Appeals. We believe this was a contested issue that was found contrary and against Fondren Bank by both the trial court and the Court of Civil Appeals. But if you accept that as a fact, it does not necessarily follow that they have proved their debt. They have to show the amount. And I would urge this court that in giving consideration to a policy opinion, a precedent, a binding opinion, as to the definition of debt for purposes not of validity of the attachment of security interest, but as to priorities of security interest, that the definition of debt must necessarily include the amount that is owed. Otherwise, it's just meaningless. When one party has a priority claim and they have a lien that is attached as to an amount of money and the other party does not, then you'll have cases being remanded all day, all year, on the question of, well, let's let him have an opportunity to prove his debt because this time he may be able to show the amount. As I said, we have four reasons.
But, excuse me, counsel, that's pretty well set out in the code, isn't it, that you're at validity of your lien is number one, to be prior in right, you've got to be prior in time, and then according to the statute, it's only to the extent of the advances made pursuant to this to the security agreement or under the security agreement, isn't it?
I think that's exactly right. I think there are two sections of the code that have to be kept in mind here. One is to the perfection of the lien, the attachment, and there it talks of value given. And there are lots of cases that go off on the point of, well, they gave value, they extended a loan, and they don't talk about amounts of money. They said, well, this is value given. But the other section, quoted by the Court of Civil Appeals, that talks about the priority between competing liens, where they are both valid and they have both attached, then which one gets priority, then, as quoted by Judge Miller in the Court of Civil Appeals, it is only to the extent that it secures advances made before he becomes a lien creditor or within 45 days thereafter. I think that's exactly right. When you're talking about priority, you have to be talking in terms of the amount of the debt. Otherwise, it's just me. And I urge the court to consider the precedential value of an opinion that will distinguish the difference between value given for purposes of attachment and the amount of the debt or the amount of the advances for purposes of priority. Further, there are two other reasons why we think the Court of Civil Appeals decision should be affirmed. One is because no bill of exceptions was ever offered in the trial court. I think it is erroneous for Fondren Bank to appear before the Court of Civil Appeals and before this court to urge a remand to that court for the opportunity to offer evidence of the amount of indebtedness when that rests purely upon speculation. We have a witness testifying based upon, in our opinion, hearsay, that there was debt continually through this period of time. And at the same time, no evidence was offered, no evidence was objected to regarding the amount of the debt, no bill of exceptions was offered. This is simply a procedural error, I think, that just makes it erroneous and would be a bad precedent for this court to allow a remand in that situation. And the other reason is because there's no causal connection. You know, the only error that the Court of Civil Appeals found, and that I submit that you can find in the trial decision, if any, is whether the security agreement should have been admitted. And we argued that and lost in the Court of Civil Appeals. Let's assume that decision was correct, as it probably was. If the security agreement's admission was error, how did that keep or prevent Fondren Bank from offering the amount of its indebtedness as evidence?
Well, he wouldn't have had anything. If he didn't have a security agreement in evidence, he couldn't put any of the evidence of any debt, could he? Because there wouldn't be any secured debt.
I disagree with that, Sean. I think that you can offer, first of all, a bill of exception. The security agreement was not offered as a bill of exceptions, although it was attached as an exhibit. But they did not proceed to prove up the rest of their case with the amount of the debt. It really is a failure of proof. They failed to prove a prima facie case. That's our position. I think that's what the Court of Civil Appeals opinion clearly sets forth.
You're saying that Fondren could prove the amount of its indebtedness even after the trial court's rejection of the security agreement into evidence?
Not only, yes, sir, not only could they, but after the security agreement, a review of the record will demonstrate the question and answer to the statement of facts will show that the security agreement was offered in the middle of the trial. The objection was carried with the case. There were other exhibits then that were offered in an attempt to prove up the rest of the case, and some were rejected, most were admitted. Then the trial court returned to the question of the security agreement. There was further evidence, there was further argument. The security agreement then was rejected. It was kept out. I submit that during the remainder of the trial, as they were going through the rest of the proof and the rest of their evidence, the proper thing to do would have been to prove their debt if they had any. You know, where's the promissory note? Where's the letter of credit? I think the unavailable, the unstated facts are what speak loudest. So this is the lack of a causal connection, we believe, is one of the real problems that the petitioner has in this case, because the harmless error rule would, of course, require them to show that keeping out the security agreement somehow prejudiced their ability to offer into evidence, either through a bill of exceptions or through a promissory note or some other form of evidence, the amount of the debt. And this goes back to one of our prior points, which is speculation. When you allow this kind of an argument to be made on appeal, then what this court must base its decision on, literally, is speculation. And that's what we all engage in arguing about, and that's what we think is improper.
Are the terms of the security agreement in the record anywhere?
Yes, sir. I believe that they are an exhibit and are part of the record. I don't have the number in front of me.
Part of the transcript or part of the exhibit that were?
One of the exhibits, and I believe they were attached to the record that went to the Court of Civil Appeals. And I'm sure they're part of the record that's before this court.
The security interest would be no evidence of that.
The security agreement?
Yeah.
Yes, I believe that's, I think that's right. The security agreement itself, and in fact I reviewed it just coming over here today, in the blank where it says amount of note or amount of debt to be secured, it's left blank. The security agreement nowhere on it has any amount of money put on there. Even if it did, security agreements of that nature are meant to secure advances that are made during various periods of time. And the wording of this particular security agreement speaks in terms of any previous debt that we've given to you, any debt that we now are extending to you, any debt that you later owe us at any later time is secured by the terms of this security agreement. Well, that's fine, but what debt is that? That's the point. If you believe the testimony and accept as uncontroverted the testimony of the vice president that they were owed money continually since 1974, and if you agree that the security agreement should have been admitted into evidence, you still do not have a prima facie case as to the priority of their lien. You may well have a valid security interest that may have attached, but you haven't got the priority under section 9.301B. And that's the difference. The difference between the validity of the security interest and the priority, when you compare that security interest to a valid garnishment lien of Marathon Eterno, which has been properly proved and offered in the evidence. Finally, the most significant question I think that can be asked of the respondent in this case is, if we assume that the fact of the debt had been established, but that simply the amount had been left out, wouldn't it be just and fair to remand? I think that's what the question that we have to squarely answer. And I think the right answer to that question is no more so than in any other case where the petitioner says, well, if we were given another chance, we could do better. If we had another trial, we might be able to prove our damages this time. We may be able to find the promissory note the next time around. This is the kind of a response or the kind of an issue that is going to be bad precedent for this court to write on that kind of policy. Additionally, the answer to that question is no, because it requires speculation, because there is nothing in the record to indicate that there was any amount of debt or what that amount would be. Again, the answer should be no, because there's no causal connection between whatever trial court error there may have been and the failure to offer the evidence of the amount of the debt, if any. The fact that they kept the security agreement out certainly has nothing to do with the fact that the petitioner failed to offer evidence of his debt. And finally, we think the answer is no, because the Court of Civil Appeals found that there was no evidence or insufficient evidence of the debt. This was specifically the finding that was addressed by the Court of Civil Appeals when they pointed out and quoted from the section which I mentioned a moment ago, that it only secures advances made by and only to the extent of those advances extended by the creditor. Consequently, when you define debt in the sense of a priority lien, you have to be talking in terms of an amount of money. Otherwise, it's just a meaningless concept. And we urge the court to follow that policy and write an opinion that will give us some guidance for future decisions on in this kind of case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Hear a rebuttal argument from petitioner.
May it please the court. Mr. Justice Spears, the security agreement is Defendant Exhibit 3 in the record.
I thought it wasn't admitted.
It was marked, however, at time of trial. It was not admitted into evidence, but it's part of the exhibit to the statement of fact. It was Defendant Exhibit 3. It was marked and offered. It was not admitted, however. Counsel for Marathon would suggest to the court that it, I think, restructured the provisions of 9.203. That provision of the Business and Commerce Code establishing what needs to be done in order for a security interest to attach. It requires that value be given by the secured party, Fondren, to the debtor, Marathon. That was shown. With that showing, all the other steps necessary for security interest to attach had coincided and had been established. There was perfection by filing with the Secretary of State's office in May of 1976, long before Marathon obtained a judgment and long before it caused the writ of garnishment to be issued. Counsel has referred to the evidence on the fact of indebtedness. The senior vice president of Fondren, Mr. Skoranek, testified that there was continuous debt from 1974 forward. It is true that he did not become an employee of the bank until October of 1976. However, there was no showing, there was no more dire of his testimony, there was no showing that he did not have personal knowledge of the amount, of the fact of indebtedness owing from 1974 when he so testified. There was no challenge to that testimony by Marathon. The evidence was received without challenge. The McCormick and Ray Texas Law of Evidence I've referred to in our application for writ of error clearly points out that where a party does not question the personal knowledge